Welcome to the Project Zion podcast. This podcast explores the unique spiritual and theological gifts Community of Christ offers for today's world.
Hello, and welcome to Project Zion podcast. This is Robin Linkhart
and Karen Peter
here today to talk about the life and times of women in Community of Christ.
So we're going to start with some introductions. So I'm the usual host of Cup of Joe. So if you are a longtime Project Zion podcast listener, you've heard me a little bit in the past, maybe too much. So we'll see as we go forward. But I serve Community of Christ as a president of 70. But what's really relevant to this conversation is that I am a female of an age where I grew up in a more patriarchal version of our denomination. Robin?
Well, I am on the Project Zion podcast team, an occasional host on the show, but most of my work is behind the scenes. I grew up in Community of Christ and currently serve in the Council of 12 Apostles. And like Karen, although I'm just a smidge older than Karen, maybe a smidge and a half, I'm also here today because I am a woman who lived the experience of Community of Christ from birth on. And we thought that we would start this conversation by sharing our story. We're going to begin with our young childhood. Karen, tell us about your young childhood in the life of Community of Christ.
So I had kind of an interesting early childhood in the life of Community of Christ because my parents, who joined the church as young adults and then became parents shortly thereafter, were part of a communal living experiment called The Project, which was in a place named Puyallup, Washington. So a shout out to all of those wonderful people. But it was several families, young families, who lived on a parcel of land and built homes and shared gardening and just experimented with some kind of weird Zionic community living experiment. So that was a little bit different for early childhood because everything about that early childhood was church because we were in this kind of project. So that changed when people began to move away from that. But it changed into a situation where we were part of a congregation that was didn't have a building. And so we moved and rented space in like VFW Hall and the Moose Lodge and those kinds of things. And that changes the experience of life in the church than from people who grow up in an established congregation. It also affects, I think, what we're talking about here today about women and men, because we were in the process of building a building. And when you are doing that, even in the early 70s, a lot of the gender dynamics come into play and a lot of them go out the window. So what comes into play is the women cooked and cleaned and the men folk built and hauled and carried. But if you were a kid, you got sucked into whatever was needed. So I did things that traditionally were male roles and I did things that were traditionally female roles. And I think that was a positive experience, even though that was still the time when only men served in church leadership. So that's my early childhood. Robin, what about you?
So I was born into the church by virtue of the fact that my mother was born and raised in Community of Christ. My father was unchurched, although after he married my mom, he was very willing to accompany her to church throughout the years, including all through our growing up. I was born in Southern California. When I was 6 weeks old, we moved to Anchorage, Alaska, because my dad was a career military in the Army Corps of Engineers, and we moved frequently during my childhood. My earliest memories of church are, in a sense, kind of a glimpse into what I would imagine a Leave It to Beaver life in Community of Christ would have looked like. Very traditional roles for men and women. Sunday school, very traditional experience of church with Sunday school for all ages, worship all together, the sacrament celebrated, of course, communion on the first Sunday. And I got to experience different cultures and sizes of congregations because we moved so often. The congregation in Southern California, San Bernardino branch, where I was baptized, was a building that had been in the church for a long time, since the early days of the church, and it was, I would say, a robust congregation, weekly attendance, and later on lived in the panhandle of Sydney, Nebraska on Sioux Army Depot, where we drove about 12 miles into town and met in a farmer's home where they lined up the chairs in the living room. Usually 12 to 15 chairs in our family, two parents and four kids were half of the congregation. Another time later in my early childhood, we lived in the Pennsylvania area where we had a large congregation that had a full-time appointee, which is an employed minister of Community of Christ, serving as the pastor there. And that congregation probably had a couple hundred weekly attendance and a really dynamic, robust children and youth program. So experienced that. Like Karen, I saw women doing the cleaning and the cooking and the child tending. My mother was a musician, and so I saw her function as the piano player or organ player for our congregation. In small congregations, she might do that every week because she might be the only one that served in that capacity. My dad did not join the church until much later, and so he functioned even as a non-member and a non-priesthood holder in a very male role and came alongside the other men assisting as was appropriate for him, which included serving on the building committee and even teaching a junior high class later on. So Karen, let's move on to like our older, later childhood. What did it look like for you?
So I think when I was like around 12, 13 years old is when I really began to be cognizant of the reality that men served in priesthood leadership and women didn't. I mean, you knew that growing up as part of the air that you breathed, it was fine. But I didn't realize the inequity of that until I was about 12 or 13 years old. And I know you have a very comparable story to this. So it's been interesting that we've been friends all these years because I decided that the way I was going to get around this situation that women couldn't serve as ordained ministers was I was going to become Catholic. And that way I could be a nun, because in my mind that would be the equivalent for women at the time. And I planned that until I looked up in the Encyclopedia Britannica kind of what that entailed and decided that was definitely not for me. And I thought I had a backup plan. And so my backup plan was when I read what I call the owner's manual, the membership manual that you got when you got baptized, I learned that we had chaplains in the military. And I thought, that's perfect. I will go in the Air Force and that way I can be a chaplain. And again, when I looked into how that happened, that probably wasn't going to work for me either. And I was very aware at that time of the discrepancy of how men and women evolved in the life of the church. And that stayed with me throughout my teenage years as I watched the teenage boys get kind of mentored differently than how the teenage girls were mentored. And this would have been the mid-70s, and it was pretty apparent. It was a time when feminism was talked about, and it was on the news a lot, and there were bra burnings, which when we talk about that now, it's kind of the equivalent of the pussy hats that women wore. That was what they were called, that they wore in the Women's March. You're laughing, but that's what they were called. And so it was the equivalent of that. And there was all kinds of like civic unrest based on feminism and that kind of thing. And it just became really apparent that that was in the life of the church as well. And there was a lot of dialogue about that in different settings. And as an older teen, I went to a youth event, and there had been some kind of disruption and some things that happened. And I came home and I was telling my dad about it. And he happened to be sitting there with a friend of his who was also a priesthood member. My dad was, he was an elder, and there was this other elder there. And I was telling him about this and how I felt about it. And the other elder, my dad would have never said this because he just didn't believe in inequity between genders. But this other guy said to me, "Oh, Karen, that's very discerning. When you get married, you'll be a wonderful helpmate to your, you know, priesthood husband." And I remember thinking, well, the heck with that. It probably wasn't heck, but it was, I'm not doing that. That is not for me. And I just kind of took several steps back and didn't participate for a long time in the life of the church, because I was like, well, that's where I'm going to end up. I'm not interested in that. And I disappeared for a little while.
I love your stories, Karen.
We'll see how much gets edited out. So we'll, yeah.
They never fail to be, I can experience them in living color and all the ways of living color. So my childhood was a little bit different, but Karen and I do have some similarities. I was fascinated by other religious traditions, in particular Catholicism. We had some family friends who had, I think they had 7 kids. He was our pediatrician, and they attended our small town Catholic church. And when I stayed overnight there, I got to go with them to church, which just captivated my imagination with the ritual and the way sacrament was lived out in the context of the Catholic church. And we had some current culture, like The Sound of Music, that was focused on the life of a novice nun, and different movies and TV shows that featured nuns. So I was captivated by that sense of a nun, although my sensitivities and awareness of the gender imbalance between male and female roles was not really something I thought about in a way that was concrete and well understood. I just knew I was captivated by the sense of following Jesus, and that it looked like the life of a nun would be a great way to do that. So one summer, I actually wore a towel on my head with little bobby pins on the side to hold the front straight across, and just imagined my life as being a nun. And somehow it didn't dawn on me that in the reality of Community of Christ, that would not be a possibility. The other thing that's different for me is that in fourth grade, my dad, career military, was deployed to Dominican Republic. And so we lived in a developing nation for 2.5 years, fourth grade through part of sixth grade, and actually totally out of the country during a lot of the social justice unrest around race and around women. So we see the civil rights movement and feminism really taking shape during that time. And so I missed that piece that would have naturally been in my life, even as a young child, that would raise my awareness and consciousness. Returned to the U.S. In mid-sixth grade, and boy, it was like a time warp, because the first thing we did was my mom took us to the local clothing shop in this little town to get clothes that matched what everybody else was wearing, which was like mini skirts and fishnet stockings and those kinds of things. And I remember my mom being horrified at the things she was seeing on the news about burning bras, and it was announced that we would never be doing that. So, it was a real fast and hard re-entry into a world that had changed on the U.S. scene. My dad was deployed to Vietnam when we right after we arrived in Nebraska. So all of that was kind of playing as a backdrop to my experience growing up in Community of Christ. Early in my junior high years, we lived in Rolla, Missouri, and we were there 3.5 years, which is the longest I had ever lived in one place in my life to that point. A lovely congregation, medium-sized. My mom played every week the organ, and it was a safe space, and it was, you know, going through puberty and adolescence and growing up, and it felt good to be in a congregation again. In Dominican Republic, there was no presence of Community of Christ, and we had formed a community church with all the U.S. and English-speaking folks who found themselves in Santo Domingo for either military or civil servant reasons. And that was a real ecumenical experience. So being back in the States and having a congregation and living into that, it was always all the men up front. Women, basically, I never saw a woman do anything in a worship service other than provide music in one way, shape, or form. One of the things we had back then, Karen, you probably did too, is we had early morning worship that was like a 15-minute little devotion time before Sunday school. And that was the time when you got to see women and men do something that would be seen even standing in the pulpit. In some congregations, it's like the pulpit was ordained, mm-hmm. and a woman couldn't use it, but they certainly could not use it during worship, but they might be able to stand there and do something, read a scripture during the early morning worship. So that was interesting, and it gave me a taste as a young woman in my teens then of, wow, this is kind of exciting. I think I like this. But again, I just had not yet clearly seeing the disparity between the roles in our church of men and women. And I think I was still kind of accepting it as the status quo, and this was what life was like. So let's talk about young adult. You've started on that a little bit, Karen, but we're out of high school, young adults, maybe some college, marriage, kids, church. Talk about that.
So I had stepped back, and I really didn't participate as a young adult in the life of the church. I had just kind of went, not for me. And so by the time I did come back, I was a mom. I was married. My son was preschool age when I started kind of dipping a toe back into congregational life. And it was about the time of what we call Section 156, which was when counsel was given to the church regarding the ordination of women. And it just happened to coincide. So I didn't come back because of that. In fact, I wasn't really interested in any kind of role in the life of the church at that time. I simply thought that it was important for my preschool child to be engaged in some kind of church experience and Sunday school experience. And when I'm one-on-one with people and I feel more comfortable with them, I'm a little more honest about that period of time. I refer to myself as a heathen during that period of time, and I was very good at it. And I excelled at heathenism and all the things that that might imply. And so I was really cautious about coming back during that time. And I didn't fully re-engage until probably the mid-1980s. So my young adult experience would have been lived outside of the church experience.
So my dad was military, as I said, career military, and in the summer before my senior year of high school, at the age of 39, my dad retired from the Army and took a role at the city of Knoxville, Tennessee, as the assistant director of wastewater control for the city of Knoxville. And he moved out to Knoxville. The family went with him, and he rented a house trailer, with the plan that my mom was going to stay behind and sell our house, and she would join my dad, and I would stay behind and live with a family in Rolla and finish out my high school years, my last year in high school, and my three sisters would go with my mom once they sold the house. So that was an interesting time for our family and an interesting time for me, because they did sell the house around Christmas time that year, and we all went out to spend Christmas with my dad, and then I came back and lived with a family in town. It was not a church family, but I went to church every Sunday as usual. And that was a time in my life when I recognized this consistent presence of the church in my life all through our moving time remained and was such a steadfast support for me in new ways, feeling alone in the town that I hadn't experienced quite that way before. And another thing that was really big in our family is while my dad was in Tennessee in the rental, and we would visit, you know, whenever we could, he was attending Community of Christ in Oak Ridge, Tennessee, and he was going through his own faith journey and experience of beginning to understand that he might want to join Community of Christ. So during that time, he was baptized and confirmed a member, which was a really big thing to me. I remember I kind of had the heart of a missionary even back then, Karen, because I really wanted my dad to join the church, and he was active and supportive in every way as far as fellowshipping. But I used to play hymns on our piano and sometimes sing, and I think, oh, if I just do this really carefully and maybe I'm prayerful about it, my dad might suddenly feel this Holy Spirit telling him that he should join the church. So it was thrilling to me that he did join the church during my senior year of high school. So I moved out to Tennessee right after I graduated from high school, walked out of the building, got in the car, and away we went. And I haven't seen almost anybody from my graduating class since that time. And I think it was about that time, as I was going to college and had my first job ever the summer before I went off to college, that I began to get what I would call the beginnings of my feminist awakening. I decided to go to what was then called Graceland College. It's now Graceland University. I was fully engaged in the church life, campus church ministry, and joined whatever I could to be part of that. Sang in the Graceland Choir, which often sang at the worship services. Was really active in student life, and the church was very present on campus. And that's when I began to realize that there were young men my age that held priesthood offices, and they functioned in those offices on campus and in the ministry programs there. And again, it was just like this slow awakening of feminism. Although I had been very conscious of social justice, especially in relation to race, it was a gentle, sometimes abrupt realizations of the disparities of the role of men and women in the life of the church. I met my husband there at Graceland. We eventually got married and settled in Longmont, Colorado, and we were active in our little congregation there. My husband had been ordained to the office of deacon right before we left Knoxville, the same day my dad was ordained to priest. And my desire to be part of the church and live out my discipleship and Community of Christ was really strong, and I had a deep sense of commitment to that. We had 3 kids in 15 months. Our daughter was born, and 15 months later I had twins, and we found ourselves in my husband's new career, which he was a career insurance agent and worked on commission only, was a journey of trying to make ends meet while he built his customer base. And it was hard. It was really hard. And I was home alone, a mom with 3 little kids, no car. The only time I went out of the house basically was to run to the grocery at 5 a.m. before my husband took our car to work, and on Sunday morning when we'd load the kids up and go. And by the time they were toddlers, I was like in a sea of wanting to participate in church but overwhelmed with childcare. And I remember feeling really angry about that. So I have to tell you that I was to the point where I was broken over that and talked to my husband and said, I can't go there anymore. If they can't even see us and do something mm-hmm. to meet our needs, I can't do that. And we actually went a few blocks down the street to a Christian congregational church and started attending. They had a great program for kids. And we even went through the new member classes, and the pastor came to visit us. And this went on for several weeks, and we hadn't heard from anybody at the church, which further affirmed to me that they don't care about me. So one of the elders in our congregation, good friends, Bob called me one Friday and asked if I would play my flute at church that coming Sunday. And I think that was Bob's way of checking in and trying to connect. And so I did, and I remember sitting in that service, and there was something about what was going on in that service that just spoke so deeply to me. And it was like, oh my gosh, our church is not perfect, but this is where God is calling me to live out my discipleship. And I did not know exactly how that was going to look. But I heard that loud and clear and went home and told my husband, I think we need to give it another try. So we started going back to church, and one thing led to another, and it wasn't long after that our church was talking seriously about what it might look like to consider ordination of women. So Karen, why don't you help flesh out the church side of our journey to ordination of a woman?
So one of the interesting things about how things happen in Community of Christ is that it's a combination of what's happening in the body of the people, what the conversation is, how resolutions are brought to World Conference can be very grassroots and how that happens. But at the same time, just the way God works with this particular body of people is that the leadership of the church is discerning and considering and dialoguing about different topics. So with the ordination of women, this was a very controversial topic. It was talked about for ages, locally, in congregations, in jurisdictions around the church, and in the leadership of the church. And it... Wallace B. Smith was president of the church, and he has, on Project Zion, talked about some of this and how it was. And Julie Smith, his daughter, has talked about what it was to live as part of the family as a female and kind of walk as a family through this, which, if you haven't listened to that episode, it's a really good one to hear her perspective as a young woman. And again, I wasn't totally engaged in the life of the church this time, but I was aware enough to know that even where I lived, which was on the West Coast, that there were a lot of people who weren't going to like this. And people were already kind of making a stand long before Inspired Council, or at that time what we called Revelation, came to the church about the ordination of women. People were kind of picking their side and lobbying and trying to sway opinion on whether this was a good idea or not. And part of what fed into this was how we understood Scripture. Is it literal? Is it cultural? Is it contextual? What do we do with Scripture? What do we do with passages in the New Testament that say women should sit down and be quiet in church? How do we understand these? And for me, it was part of the process of becoming a more scripturally literate people was this whole journey towards the ordination of women, which we're still on that journey. We're still engaging in what that means in the life of the church. But this is what kind of happened locally, as far away from Independence as I lived, that people were picking their battles. And when Wallace B. Smith brought the council to the church about the ordination of women and priesthood responsibility and generosity and the temple, lots of wonderful things in section 156, people honed in on that ordination of women as the topic, and it was divisive. It in the Midwest was really ugly, but even out where we lived out on the West Coast, it was not a pleasant situation, and most congregations lost people who just couldn't accept that, couldn't live with that. But the interesting thing, as disruptive as it was in the life of the church, and it was disruptive, it was almost a blink of an eye before it became normative for women to be ordained. I mean, there was a pause between the revelation and the procedure of ordaining women, but once it started to take place, generally it was just simply how it was. And you really didn't realize that hadn't been the practice all along. So by the time I came back, women had just been started to be ordained. In fact, my mother was called, which is probably one of the reasons I even was aware of all of this. And you wouldn't have known that women hadn't served in priesthood all this time. Except there were little pockets of resistance all over the place. And in those pockets, and some of them still exist today, ordination of women was never accepted. It was never something that was accepted or championed in any way. So that was what it looked like for me, from kind of one foot in, back in the church, and one foot out, watching it happen. What about you?
So section 156 in the Doctrine and Covenants came out in 1984. And as Karen said, that journey was divisive. People had sometimes very polarized opinions about that. It had been in our conversation for a long time. And if we look back in the history, we can see it emerged really a ways before that and kind of trickled down and had come in full dialogue in the years just prior to 1984. I was in my little congregation in Longmont, Colorado, and I had one child in 1982, two children in 1983, and as you can imagine, not all my attention was on reading the Herald every time and paying attention to conversations. But that spring of 84, I flew with my three kids back to visit my parents, and World Conference was happening while I was staying with them. And my grandparents, who had been converts to Community of Christ, lived in the same town. And so I remember caring for my three little kids, and my Grumpy would come over, and Graham, and they would give little reports from World Conference. And I remember them being like very unsettled and distraught. And that's when I heard the news that Section 156 had come out. And it was really hard for my grandparents. It was difficult for my mom. My dad was very accepting of that. Went back to my home congregation, and we lost half of our congregation. And it was a struggle for our little congregation to go forward. I think those who remained behind were very committed. Our pastor did not yet have his own affirming testimony of Section 156, and so he prayerfully walked with that. He was very supportive of the church, fully committed, served faithfully in that role, and went to the rededication of the Kirtland Temple not long after that. And it was during that service that he received spiritual confirmation that this was God's will. And he, not long after that, processed some calls for women to the priesthood in our congregation. It was beautiful to see women step into those roles. And because our congregation wasn't really in a metropolitan area, I didn't have the opportunity to see how, you know, the five larger congregations in Denver lived into that. I was in a district, and the district at large was very accepting. It wasn't long before we had a woman district president. We actually had two female district presidents in a row. So I was seeing that lived out, and seeing how the nature and experience of worship and ministry as one who was receiving that took on new dimensions. Before we had two women in our congregation called, we had a young couple and their kids move out, and they were in Colorado for one or two years, but she had been ordained before she came. And so that was our very first experience. I think she was in the office of teacher. And that was a tremendous experience. When we had our fourth child in 1988, I stepped back from active engagement in the life of the church. I attended every week, but I had been doing all kinds of things like teaching classes and directing the choir and helping out with everything that was going on. And I decided, you know, I need to just step back from that kind of involvement and just be a regular attender. And the first year of of our last child's life and be present with my family and kids. And that was a really important thing for me because it allowed me to drink and become spiritually fed and take time to kind of sift and sort and begin a journey that Karen began much earlier than I did, of beginning to understand the depth of the theological transformation that was undergirding our capacity as a people to step into this and make this journey, and to recognize the enormous gift that is resident in how Community of Christ experiences and lives continuing revelation, that it's a dynamic way of listening to God and allowing us in a changing, complex world and culture and context to live and breathe and walk with God and listen deeply to how God is calling us to be and to become and to grow, even when it's really hard. And sometimes we go kicking and screaming. Mm-hmm. So that was really a dynamic time. I was called to priesthood in 1995. So my kids were had grown quite a bit. My older three were in junior high. My younger one was in elementary school. It was something that I had felt stirring in me, that I sensed that I had a call to ordain ministry. I wasn't certain of the office. I was thinking teacher, maybe priest, and it didn't come. I mean, I was feeling the stirring probably for a year, and it didn't come. And I finally decided, well, I can serve and be active and follow Jesus anyway, regardless of whether I'm ordained or not. So I just decided to let go of that, to maintain that sense of call and apply that sense of call to however I had the capacity and opportunity to serve. And it wasn't long after that my pastor came to visit on a Sunday afternoon and presented me, to my great shock and surprise, a call to the office of elder. And that's kind of when I started swimming in the deep end of what it felt like to live into this on the participant side of being asked to serve in that way. So up to then, it had been receiving ministry and observing mm-hmm. how the depth of ministry took on new and beautiful dimensions. And then it got really real in a different way. So Karen, how were things unfolding at that point? So tell us a little bit about your experience of receiving calls and how that was for you. You'd re-engaged in the life of the church. What was going on and what did it look like?
I did re-engage. It would have been the late 1980s when I did so. Finally decided I'd put both feet back into church life and congregational life. And I was really lucky in a sense that the congregation I re-engaged in was the one I had grown up in, but it had really transformed. It was a large congregation then. By the time I re-engaged, it was very welcoming and very inclusive in a lot of ways. It had some really positive effects on me in the sense that even when I was a kid, I was invitational. You know, the way you were talking about your dad and you thought you could do these things. The way I expressed it was that I never went to anything of a church event without taking somebody with me. It was just the normal thing to do. You invited friends to go with you. And so when I re-engaged in the life of the church, I had that same kind of a way of living my discipleship was always about invitation and inviting other people to come with me, sometimes intentionally and sometimes unexpectedly. But I re-engaged about 1988 fully. And as a person who was not a priesthood member, I was still invited to facilitate worship services and offer public ministry and those kinds of things, because that's just the kind of congregation that it was. And so I got a lot of opportunities to serve, even though I was not an ordained priesthood member. But in 1992, I received a call to the office of elder. So it was a similar kind of expression of, oh, okay, well, let's see what that looks like as we navigate that together. And my husband at the time was he had finally joined the church, but he kept most of it at a distance, and so he was a member, and he participated in some things, but he was not going to ever be interested in any kind of leadership or priesthood or anything like that. And I thought it was interesting that the pastor took that into account, but didn't let that determine whether or not he presented a call to me, which I thought was really forward thinking. I know of many, many cases, even now, where, the spouse might not be, you know, okay with this or supportive of this. And I'm a real advocate for let the person who's called make that decision on what their personal relationship is like and whether it can weather this kind of leadership in the church. So I did accept that call, and I was ordained to an elder in 92, and then served in my congregation, but also served at that time it was a stake, Seattle stake. So I served in different capacities there as well. And I still had this, you know, heathen reputation to kind of overcome to some degree, but I was pretty diligent in that and had a lot of support and friends and other leaders that were supportive and mentored me in lots of different ways, which I think is critical for people, in newly ordained people, to get that kind of mentorship from others who have walked the path before them. And then in 1995, I received a call to the office of 70. And I was in my 30s, and there were some women serving in the office of 70, one, you know, fairly local, but not a lot when I went to my first quorum gatherings and those kinds of things. And that some of those occasions were the first times I was referred to as that I was referred to in diminutive terms for being female. That was my first encounter with, I'm going to say, gender bias in the life of the church post 156 was in some of the quorum gatherings originally, just because I was a young woman who had been ordained to the office of 70. So that was surprising to me because I had not experienced that yet. But I fully embraced that and feel like I really lived into that priesthood office. And that was, you know, a really authentic call for me, and really I was very serious about it and have been able to really use my nature of being a person of invitation in ways that has encouraged that kind of ministry in others, which is, I think, the best part of being in church leadership, is being able to do that. So those were my kind of local priesthood call experiences. You and I were shared the experience in 2007 of being approached about serving in a new capacity, S70, and that was something that was at the field level where we were partnered with apostles. And it was called a field missionary coordinator, and we both served in that role for several years. And in some ways that was uncomfortable, and in other ways it was really informative and helpful. I didn't think I'd say that at the time, but I can say it now. And then in 2010, we were both called to serve as presidents of 70, and I have served as a president of 70 ever since. There were several women serving as presidents of 70 at that time. Currently, as we record this, there's only me, though I'm only female on that council. And I consider it part of my responsibility to make sure that the field apostles and others who are in church leadership are looking particularly for young women to serve in the office of 70, because that's how we get leaders in the life of the church, is we intentionally mentor others. And in the role of 70 in the life of the church, that doesn't always happen for women. And so I'm really concerned about that and what that looks like going forward. So how about you?
Well, I want to ask you a question, Karen, before I continue my story, and that is along that trajectory of your ordination to elder and then now in the Council of Presidents of 70, you became full-time employed minister with Community of Christ.
I did.
So when did that happen?
you and I have had such similar trajectories. I feel bad. It's like, I'm going to tell your part of the story, too. So you and I both actually started in employed ministry kind of late 1998, but I think our start date is January 1, 99. So we're in our 23rd year, which makes me feel very, very old and experienced. But I've served in lots of capacities. So I served, you know, local jurisdictions. I served as what was called a Transformation 2000 minister. I've served as a what was called a field minister and a mission center minister, and now as I went under church appointment, which I think you explained earlier, in 2004. So I started in 99, went under appointment in 2004, and have served under appointment ever since to where I am. And I'm several years short of retirement, but it is something that will happen at some point.
So as I said, I was ordained, called to elder in 95 and ordained in 1996. It was the year that I turned 40. One interesting thing about that call is I was called in September before the new year started. We had a pastor coming in from a neighboring congregation because we didn't have anyone in the congregation that was willing or able to serve. And the district president had approached me that fall to ask if I would serve as Charlie's counselor. Now, my call had been approved, but my ordination wasn't going to happen until March. And so that was just kind of like knocked me flat, like, you what? Said, I won't even be ordained until March. And she's like, that is totally fine. So it was a steep learning curve. And the experience I had then, which is one that has played out over and over and over again in my life of ministry, is this sense that God consistently calls me into roles that I feel unprepared and unqualified to serve. And it's a leap of faith to say yes to those calls. So I was already serving as the assistant pastor the day I was ordained in March. And then the following fall, that fall, I was elected pastor, and that started January 1 of the following year. And I had so much to learn. And it was such a steep learning curve. And because I grew up in a home where I did not have the benefit of a priesthood holder. My father didn't hold priesthood until I had been gone from home for a while. I had this big gap in what people would assume I might know because I grew up in the life of the church as a lifelong member. And especially since we moved so much, it would have been my dad only that was like that model of what lived out priesthood looks like close up. So the first time I was going to be presiding for a communion service, and it was the first time I was actually going to serve the communion also, I was terrified. And I grabbed an old-time friend, Bob, and I just took him in the hall, and I said, Bob, I need you to tell me how to do this. And he goes, Robin, you have been doing this your whole life. And I said, no, I've been out there. I haven't been on this side of the table. So I was constantly grabbing men to teach me how to do things, from communion to everything else that I was called to do and responsibilities in ministry, how to do it, what it looked like, where could I get resources. And I was just rapidly consuming everything I could get my hands on and watching people live their ministry through a new lens, because I needed to know what they knew and I needed to understand how God was calling me to live into those roles, and to also understand that this was part of me living into the all of who I was, who God created me to be. And there's a sense of authenticity that that goes into that. And that is lived differently in diverse ways, in contexts and cultures, in men and in women. And And it's been frightening to step out into that. And also, it's been the deepest joy of my life. So I served as pastor from 1997 to 2003. As Karen said, 1 January 1999 was my first day as a field specialist, a Transformation 2000 member, which was a different category than the old-time appointee, but still a full-time minister. And my assignment was to serve as a pastor in my home congregation, and that had turned into a journey of looking outward into the community and understanding how was God calling our congregation to live and be part of the neighborhood where our building was, how to be part of the greater community, how to invite others, how to be fully present and vibrant witnesses of Jesus Christ by virtue of how we lived our lives in and out of the congregation. In 2003, we went into Mission Center formation, and my role shifted, and 2003 was my last year serving as pastor in Longmont, and I was reassigned to the Rocky Mountain Mission Center and served as a congregational support minister and later as a Mission Center invitation support minister. And then in 2007, as Karen said, I too was called to serve as, I was called to serve in the office of 70 and to serve as a field missionary coordinator alongside Apostle Dale Luffman. So Karen and my journey really began to weave together. We had been aware and knew each other outside of that time because our cross had passed in different ways, in particular through our time in seminary. And then walking into this new role and new way of being that the church had never had before, with 70 serving alongside apostles who at that time were not presidents of 70. So we had four unique field missionary coordinators and seven presidents of 70. And then in 2010, with Karen being called to serve as a president of 70, and this was really exciting because in the Doctrine and Covenants that had been accepted that year, 163, I believe, had made provision for the number of presidents of 70 to be in response to the need and not bound by there would always be only seven or at maximum seven. And that was the year we had 10 presidents of 70, each yoked in mission with an apostle in their geographic assignment area. And that began a new chapter of our journey, for sure.
It really was, and it was so different because as a female president of 70, I was assigned to a female apostle, which was great. And you had a very different experience because you were assigned to a male apostle.
Yeah, I was assigned to a male apostle, and not only that, he'd been my professor in seminary.
And he was awesome, but still...
It was a little overwhelming. And another thing they did, Karen, that I forgot about until just now, is we were partnered with another team. So I was partnered, well, Dale and I were partnered with Mary Jack Steins and Chris Judd, who was the president of 70. And so we had three females and one male in our partnership.
Poor Dale.
What did yours look like?
Let's see. We were partnered with Carlos Mejia and Bob Kreiser.
Wow.
Yeah. So it was... It was two and two.
Awesome.
So, yeah, absolutely.
Awesome. And then in 2016, I was called to serve in the Council of 12 Apostles, and continuing to be yoked in mission with my president of 70, who has been Karen all this time.
So we stay entwined in our journey here.
We are really entwined, aren't we?
We are.
I think one of the things, Karen, as we began to go into general officer roles and have a different view of the global church is seeing how women in ministry and leadership has unfolded across the different nations of the church, and to be have a front row seat, for example, to the journey of Catherine Mambwe from Zambia, who is now in the Council of 12, but I don't think she was even a Mission Center financial officer when we first met her, was she?
No, she became a bishop and then became the financial officer after. I think we met her when she was a leader, but she wasn't a Mission mm-hmm. Center officer.
Mm-hmm. My first World Conference was 1998, and that was the year that the first two women were called to serve in the Council of 12, Gail Mengel and Linda Booth. Later, Stacy Cram was called to serve in the presiding bishopric, and then later, Stacy went into the 12. Susan Oxley went into the 12.
Mary Jex Dines,
and Barbara Carter, Mareva Arnaud. And Becky Savage went into the first presidency.
Yeah, that's all been. When you think about it, in our journey, that's all been within this last part of our journey. Mm-hmm. And it's really interesting. That was my first conference as well. And so my entire experience has been one where women have been in World Church leadership. Mm-hmm.
And then to watch also as the dialogue that goes on in the councils and quorums of the church and see how the dynamics of living into gender equity and the dynamics of male and female roles as we live that out contextually in our culture, which now includes cultures from all over the globe, and to see how people develop and grow. Watching, because we were in the Council of Presidents of 70, we were part of International Leadership Council for a couple years, and to watch this representation of leaders from around the church, I think there were like 70 people they would bring in mm-hmm. To have very important conversations and dialogue with the first presidency, not to listen to the first presidency speak, mm-hmm. but to receive questions and openings for dialogue into really important issues facing the life of the church mm-hmm. because the presidency wanted to hear what other cultures and leaders had to say around the world, and to watch that voice, both male and female, mm-hmm. grow stronger and more confident about really saying the truth of what their experience yeah, was.
Absolutely. And that was a really good experience for me, because as a person whose field assignment has always been in the United States, that colors my understanding of what it means to be a people of justice, what it means to be a people of peace, because I'm part of a preferenced culture and a wealthy culture. So it was a really good experience for me. It's also been really interesting. I joke sometimes when people say things, I'll say, oh, my feminist hackles are kind of standing up there. We're not perfect. I mean, we've been engaged in this journey for some time, and it's not just gender equality. It's equality for all people to really live that out. And we're not perfect in it. We have pockets where we don't have gender equality. We have pockets where we don't have equality for people who identify in a sexuality that's not heterosexual. And so, you know, we're still struggling. We still have remnants of colonialism and racist behavior in some of our elements of our community together. But when we find them, I think the interesting thing is that when we find them, we're getting really good about acknowledging it and then figuring out what to do about it. And I know a lot of times, you know, I'll raise the subject that, you know, women still aren't paid the same as men in big parts of this. And it's like, yeah, but as an American woman, I'm still, you know, I've still been privileged in that. And so the church is really focusing on making sure across the board that compensation is fair and just and equal and those things. And I really take pride, I guess, in that we're willing to look where we're not doing as well as we should and go, got to work on that. So, not just as a people, but as individuals.
Mm. Yeah, for sure. Yes, it's always an inward and outward journey. Which is like, rats, you mean I have to look at myself again?
I know, too. What is it about me? I also think that, you know, we've had decades to deal with this. When we talk about 1984, to me, that's yesterday. But in reality, it's not. It's a long time ago. And we've been able to live into this. And so, you know, we talked earlier about what does that look like for people who are experiencing this in a much more rapid way than what we did, and learning how to walk with them out of our experience with this.
Yeah, I think that's really important, Karen. As you were talking, it reminds me how much we learned from the journey to women's ordination that has informed us on how to walk with and pastorally support in sensitive ways the journey of change. Like Karen said, the whole globe was not in the same place with women's issues when the provision for ordination of women was made. And we still, in some nations, are supporting the local leaders, the apostles of certain fields, to do whatever we can to support that, to support their leadership and engaging with their people with education and advocacy, dealing with change so that they can bring that about in a way that does the least amount of harm and supports women. And from that journey, it has informed us greatly in how we approached full inclusion for LGBTQ+ in the U.S. and other nations, understanding that we opened ourselves to that journey with the provision that it would not be a mandate for all nations, but national conferences were the pathway to that, and understanding the timing for that would be different. And I think this whole living into change and providing the network of education and support and dialogue and helping people work through things contextually and mm-hmm. to lead, to be their own leaders, are the ones that are helping them walk through that because they know their culture. We don't. So that colonialism, understanding and confessing mm-hmm. when we have been part of colonization as far as bringing and importing our own culture and context of the church into other places, yeah. And understanding that we need to hear and listen to local leaders and equip them and develop them as best we can to support the process, but they are the leaders of that process. I remember Mareva Arnaud came to audit in seminary. Do you remember that?
I do remember.
French Polynesia. I don't think she was, she may have been a mission center officer then, I'm not sure. Steve Graffio, who's in the presiding bishopric, his family, his dad was an appointee and a apostle and presiding evangelist. They spent a large portion of time in French Polynesia. So Steve Graffio was fluent in French, and he would sit with Mareva and translate, and to watch Mareva grow uh-huh. and develop. And now she serves as an apostle on the Council of 12. And to be with her in French Polynesia and watch her as she masterfully and full of grace leads and walks with the people that she is called to serve is amazing. Absolutely amazing. As Karen said, gosh, going through what we have and then having the opportunity to walk with women who are transitioning into Community of Christ and coming from other denominations who do not ordain women, women who are going through very similar journey that we and others like us mm-hmm. went through in a collapsed time frame, and watching the struggle of that. What are some of the things you've witnessed, Karen, or that you understand about that process?
Well, it's really interesting because we always compare to our own experience. And I know my own experience, because it was, you know, decades in the making, that's, it's so different. But when I watch women going through it now, they encounter Community of Christ, they come from a more patriarchal tradition, and yearn for that kind of liberation to be able to serve according to their giftedness. And so when they have the opportunities to do so, it's exciting, it's liberating, it's all the things that people, you know, hope and yearn for, to be really recognized as a valuable, equal member and participant. But at the same time, it isn't enough to just go, oh, women can be ordained here in Community of Christ, I can serve here, and that's great. Even in doing that, because the time frame is so collapsed, women in ministry who come from a really highly patriarchal society still, I think, it have to be aware that your roots run deep. So I think of it like a plant, a little flower plant. as you explore the opportunity to serve in ministry, it's like you watch women bloom in that. But we have to remember that underneath there's this root system that is rooted in patriarchy. And so different things become really hard to deal with. To give an example, one that I run into kind of a lot is that women are like, oh, this is so wonderful because I feel so liberated and I was called to serve in the priesthood and it's just been a lovely experience in my congregation and blah, 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 blah. And then they take a class. I teach a preaching class. And so they take the preaching class. And at some point in the preaching class, I say, listen, when you're offering public ministry, there are parameters. Here are some of the parameters. And it's always women who go, whoa, 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 wait, are you telling me there are things I can't say? Because there's this idea that, oh, I've been liberated to do all of this stuff, and all of a sudden there's no boundaries. And it's like, they're for all of us. For all of us, there are boundaries. That's life in a community, that there always are boundaries. And in Community of Christ, they're really far apart. They're wide. But we have to recognize that we stand and serve as representatives of Community of Christ. And we have an accountability, not just to the institution, but to the people of Community of Christ. And so when we serve in public ministry, there are boundaries. And women come up against them. They come up against it hard. And that's that root system. Mm. That's the reaction to, that feels like when I was in this heavily patriarchal thing and men were telling me what I can do, only now, honestly now it's a woman telling me what I can do. And so we have to recognize that root system, the way that we were shaped and formed is still intact because we didn't have the time to really dismantle it. Mm-hmm. I think when you take decades to go through a change, you have more time to do that. But to be honest, as a 63-year-old woman, there are times when I'm doing something and I get tweaked because my root system was still in that kind of a patriarchal experience. And so I have empathy for women going through that, but we have to recognize that yes, there are boundaries that are diminished when we come into Community of Christ, but that doesn't mean it's a free-for-all.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, for sure. I think some of the things that I've heard women express who are making this transition reflects the lack of opportunity they have had to serve in various roles that Karen and I were able to serve in even before women mm-hmm. were ordained, and to live into that and to have modeled for us other women that had leadership roles in the women's department or teaching. And although they were working in collaboration with men who were the leaders of the congregation, they actually had a lot of autonomy in contrast to how some other expressions of Christianity are that don't ordain women. And the other thing is when we are born into any kind of context or culture or faith that has very clearly defined rigid gender roles, women's self-expression and self-discovery can be shut down to the point that women who transition into Community of Christ, who are lovely, oftentimes very well-educated, capable women, have not had the opportunity or been encouraged to do the self-discovery mm-hmm. and exploration of who they really are and who they feel called to be. And that's not an overnight journey either. So helping women peel back the layers of self-discovery and then find healing and wholeness for the woundedness that they come with in a patriarchal system where they have experienced shame, judgment, even really difficult situations, and finding some sense of repair. And those triggers can come up along the way. And, mm-hmm. and those triggers are connected to those deep, deep roots. So it's been really important, I think, to understand the particular journey of women. And then what does that look like to live out, not just in a church context, congregational life, but how does that affect their relationships in home, with husband? And sometimes it's a mixed faith marriage where maybe the husband is still active in their in her prior religion, or maybe has walked away from religion altogether. Or sometimes men very much support all of it, but the lived experience and patterns of life when you're living in response to a heavily patriarchal defined relationship can be really difficult to navigate, even when both partners are fully on board and trying to explore this new thing.
Yeah, it sounds good. It sounds good. Yes, my wife should have equal, be treated equally. And yes, accept that priesthood call. That's wonderful. And then all of a sudden, it's like, wait a minute. Where do I fit? You know, I hear men say that. Now, where do I fit mm-hmm. in this then? Because that used to be my job, and now you're doing it. So what does that say for our relationship? And different people experience it differently. But there, I've met with folks who the male partner in a male-female relationship has been super supportive and is able to make that transition with grace. And I've watched where that has not been the case, where mm-hmm. It becomes a struggle for people. But in reality, that happens whether it's a male-female relationship or a same-gender relationship or a long-term community of Christ relationship.
Absolutely. You
know, we all have it. We just see it so clearly when it's in this compressed time frame of transition for folks who are experiencing community of Christ as a really joyful, liberating place to live out their spiritual journey. So,
for sure. And it's been super important, I think. Karen, you can speak to this too, but I hear over and over how helpful it is for both men and women, regardless of sexual orientation or pairing, that seeing Community of Christ model male and female working side by side, both heterosexual, LGBTQ+, mm-hmm. seeing that modeled in a community, both as couples, as families, as singles, young and old, has been such a important dimension of learning and discovering what their own path and journey can look like for them.
Absolutely. And that's a good reminder, I think, for Community of Christ congregations that have families coming out of a really patriarchal experience into their congregational life, is to remember that it's a good thing when the men folk go into the kitchen to wash the dishes after a shared meal. And it's a great thing when women are presiding and serving the sacrament, to be sure and model all the various ways in which we can reverse some gender stereotypes and some expressions of ministry that have been long held in with a certain viewpoint. It just makes all the difference in the world. And I've watched lots of times my husband, who was a church appointee for 25 years, we would be somewhere and he would make a point if there was a crying baby, even if he was the Mission Center president, he would go over and pick up that baby and take it to the back of the room and cuddle it and help it quiet down. And I've heard young women say, I can't believe, and it's because he's male and because he was a church leader, I can't believe he did that. But we all need to do that. We all need to model that it isn't gender that makes us servant ministers. It's call.
Mm. I love that. Well, Karen, is there anything that you want to say today that you haven't had a chance to share?
No, I've said all kinds of things that probably need to be edited out. So I think I'm probably done.
Well, I think this has been really fun to do this together. I want to say a special thanks to all of our listeners. Be sure to check out our other episodes. Karen noted a few earlier on in this podcast. We offer several about the life and times of women in Community of Christ. So check that out. This is Karen Peter and Robin Linkhart, and you are listening to Project Zion Podcast. Go out and make the world a better place. Take care. Bye-bye.
Thanks for listening to Project Zion Podcast. Subscribe to our podcast on Apple Podcast, Stitcher, or whatever podcast streaming service you use. And while you are there, give us a 5-star rating. Project Zion Podcast is sponsored by Latter-day Seeker Ministries of Community of Christ. The views and opinions expressed in this episode are of those speaking and do not necessarily reflect the official policy or position of Latter-day Seeker Ministries or Community of Christ. The music has been graciously provided by Dave Hines.